Thank you for tuning in. You are listening to BiteRadio.me's The Mystical Crew Show. For network or show information, visit www.biteradio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, The Mystical Crew Show with your host, Robert Sharp.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of The Mystical Crew Show. Today, my very special guest is Carla Wills Brandon. Carla always wanted to do two things professionally, to be of service to others and to write. And she has published 12 books, one of which was on a Publisher's Weekly bestseller. Considered a relationship and trauma expert, many of her media appearances have been dedicated to discussing healthy intimacy, recovery from sexual abuse, and trauma resolution. Carla has been investigating spirituality and other related phenomena for over a decade. Her major radio show appearances have been dedicated to topics ranging from near-death experiences, after-death communications, deathbed visions, and premonitions. She is considered to be one of the leading researchers into deathbed visions. In her private practice, grief work, lectures, and workshops, she teaches people how to integrate these unusual encounters into everyday living. Currently, she is working on another project involving the mysterious departing visions of the dying. For more information, you can visit Carla's website, which is www.carlawillsbrandon.com. That's CarlaWillsBrandon.com. And I do have a direct link to Carla's website in the show page description for easy access. And also want to let you know that if you would like to ask Carla any questions, feel free to call in. The number is 619-789-4359. Or if you're listening in the chat room, feel free to type your questions in there, and I'll be sure to ask Carla. So with that, let me go ahead and welcome Carla to the show. Good day, Carla. Thanks for joining me today.
Hey, Robert. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, thank you. This is going to be an interesting conversation. I've been looking forward to this ever since we had it scheduled. So,
there we go. Oh my gosh, expectations. I guess I better pull it together here.
I can let you know you'll exceed them already. So there you go. If you wouldn't mind, just share with our listeners a little bit of your background and how it is that you got interested in this phenomenon. I think it's always useful for listeners to kind of get a good sense of where the guest is kind of coming from.
Well, I'm going to go ahead and start at the beginning because that's the best place to always start. I grew up in California, and I grew up in a very public family. My grandfather was a politician. My dad played for the Boston Red Sox, and my mother looked like Marilyn Monroe. She was drop-dead gorgeous, and he was pretty good-looking, too. And as a consequence to that, and as a consequence to growing up, I grew up in a very ethnic family. My father's family, a lot of them had escaped the communist regime in Russia and avoided going to the gulags, and they had come to the United States, but they left a lot of relatives back there, so of course there was a lot of trauma. But we were a very public family, and you were not supposed to air your laundry in public. You weren't supposed to feel your feelings, express yourself. You were supposed to behave and look a certain way, and so I knew how to do the Queen's way, but I always sort of laugh when I talk about that. And so I looked really together on the outside, just like the rest of the family. My parents eventually divorced after my father's baseball career ended. And to be honest with you, I was so happy I was going to do the chicken dance. I mean, they were just, some people are just not suited, and they definitely weren't suited. But shortly after that, she developed breast cancer. She was only 33 years old. And back then, treatments were incredibly harsh. They were really difficult. There were no 12-step programs, support groups, nutritionists. It was women back then. They went through these horrible procedures, and they basically hid out in their bedrooms. And if they were lucky, like my great aunt, they survived. And if they weren't lucky and they were like my mother, well, it was a difficult experience. And so, of course, you know, she didn't know how to feel any of her feelings, and none of us talked about her illness, and we just kind of carried on and acted as if the only moment of discussion about her situation involved when she got the news that it was terminal. And she got the news over the phone, of all things. And I happened to be there with her, and I was only 15 years old, and I remember saying to her, we need to just pray. And I became the parent, and she became the child. And so my grandparents basically were in and out caretaking, but of course we didn't talk. Nobody talked. And even though she was, it was getting much worse. I mean, there were all sorts of physical things that were happening to her. Her strength was gone. She was swelling up. It moved into her pancreas and into her liver. But of course, none of us talked about it. And the only one who would say anything was my father. And my father, who, God love him, he had a bucket load of addictions and problems, but he said to us, he said, "Your mom is going to most likely be dead in 5 months." Now, we were horrified. We were horrified because this was new news for us. And so, of course, that got tucked away, too, and he was villainized, and we were back to playing the normal Brady Bunch. I went to a rock concert with a bunch of my girlfriends, and I suddenly became very ill before Sly came on stage, and I found an ambulance, and I asked if I could lay down in the back of the ambulance, and I was told that I could. Well, when I got home after the concert, I learned that my mother had been taken away in an ambulance at the exact moment I had crawled into an ambulance. Later on, I learned that that was what was called an empathetic deathbed vision, where the living will experience what the dying are going through. So an individual can be cross-country, somebody could be in your neck of the woods, and I myself could be here going through the process of dying, and let's say I suddenly have a heart attack. Let's say you, Robert, in your location, you suddenly feel a crushing sensation in your chest, and you feel nauseous, and you feel it's your end. You don't know what's going on, and then suddenly you feel okay. On my end, I've made the trip to the other side. That's an example of an empathy. And then you find out maybe 20 minutes later that I've passed from a heart attack. That's an empathetic departing vision. But, of course, I didn't know what that was, so I tucked that away with the comments that my father had made about her passing in 5 months. Well, when she went to the hospital, she ended up staying in the hospital, and I was awakened by unknown forces. Today I know what those forces were. It was my mother tapping me on the shoulder, and I knew intuitively that she had moved on to the afterlife, and I just knew it. And so I went downstairs and I waited for a family friend to call us and let us know that she had indeed made the trip. And I felt very calm. And the phone rang, and woe was me, there was a family friend letting me know that she had moved on. And so after that, I proceeded to call others in the hospital. Now, at the same time, there were two other family friends who awoke in very different locations, knowing that she had moved on. But I wouldn't learn about that for 10 years because, you know, like I said, nobody talked. And then just last year, I found out from a cousin of mine that she and that great aunt of mine who had survived her bout with breast cancer, they both had also awakened and known that my mother had moved on. So there are five of us awoke at the exact moment of her passing. But, you know, backwards, pedal backwards, nobody talked about her passing. Nobody talked about to me or my sisters about what a funeral was, what she would look like in the coffin. We were totally unprepared. My grandmother on my mother's side, she crushed up phenobarbital. She was a nurse. She crushed up phenobarbital and dumped it in my grandfather's orange juice and put it in our peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. And so I didn't even feel, I didn't feel a thing while I was floating around that funeral. After the fact, we, of course, were whisked off to the coast of California, and there were some things that took place, and I quickly found that stash of phenobarbital and continued medicating myself and did that along with some other mood-altering chemicals for about 12 years before I sobered up. So, you know, in my family, we just did not talk about tragedy and we didn't talk about death and dying. And when people are not allowed to have their feelings, oftentimes addiction will come into play. Because we have these emotions, sadness, anger, loss, grief, and we want to be numb. And so I see a lot of people in my practice who come in with some sort of addiction, and when we get down to it, usually there's a loss of some sort. What I did, like all untreated grief survivors, I decided to go into the field of psychology to see if I could figure out what the heck was wrong with me. And in the process of doing that, of course, I did begin to get my own act together because it's not, you know, you want your therapist to be a little healthier than you are. It's not a good thing. If you're going to go see a helping professional, just make sure they've got their act together, just at least a tad. Mm-hmm. So thankfully, I was able to do that, and, of course, I began to specialize in trauma. And I became a part of what was called the recovery movement, which was a really big deal in the late 80s and the 90s. And so I went and lectured in the UK and across the United States with the who's who of that era. I was the youngest of the bunch, and I specifically talked about physical abuse, sexual abuse, PTSD, eating disorders, alcoholism, drug addiction, religious addiction. Actually, I remember being in Charlotte, North Carolina, and I was talking about the Ku Klux Klan, and because I had been working with a lot of clients who had been raised in the Ku Klux Klan, and I'll never forget being picketed by the Ku Klux Klan. It was a very interesting time. But, you know, in working with trauma, what of course, there's death and dying. And with death and dying come afterlife encounters. And up until that point, of course, I hadn't really talked about my experiences because my peers, my mental health peers, were telling me that it would be professional suicide for me to talk about that. So when I would try to talk to them about what I had experienced with my mother's passing, they would shake their heads. And, of course, I was so young, I thought, well, these people must know what they're talking about. And so I just, again, shelved my encounters. Well, my son, my youngest son, my father-in-law was one of these guys. He was the hero of the family. He had gone back and rescued a lot of my husband's family from the concentration camps, and he had actually led the French through Paris because he knew the back streets really, really well when the war had ended. And so he liked climbing pyramids. I remember panting and breathing really hard as he, in his early 80s, was like jogging up the pyramid in Chichen Itza. I mean, he was a real character. Well, when he began to pass, what happened with my youngest was that he began to talk about somebody named Domus, and he would go on and on and on about Domus. Domus is here, and Domus this, and Domus that. And what I would ask him about Dom is he would look at me as if I was as dumb as dirt, and he would say things like, well, Dom is sitting right here. And I kind of brushed it off, made the huge mistake of not taking it seriously, like a lot of parents, and brushed it off to the stress that was going on in the family. Well, my husband took my youngest son to, we had a 100-year-old office, and so it required some maintenance, and it was a great place to see clients. We had a resident ghost. I mean, it was just, you know, it had everything you could possibly want in a 100-year-old house. But he and Michael went to go pick up the mail, and they found a possum, one of the, you know, big old long nasty-looking possum dead. So my son said to my husband, the possum went to the sky. The possum went to the sky, and Dom's going to go to the sky, and Domus is taking him to the sky. Well, on a Friday the 13th, right after Hanukkah, my children's favorite holiday, after the news, in my husband's arms, my father-in-law passed away. He gently passed away. And it's kind of funny because he always had a really wicked sense of humor, so it would figure he would die on a Friday the 13th. But that night, what we had done before he had passed is we had been spending some time with a rabbi friend of ours, and I asked this rabbi friend if he had ever heard the term Domus, and he wrote it out in Hebrew, and then he wrote it out in Aramaic, and he said, oh, my goodness sakes, that's the angel of death. Where did your son hear that? He's only three. That's a pretty, that's an archaic term. So my youngest son was being visited by a red-haired kid who was the angel of death, who was going to take his dad to the sky. And after Pop passed, Domus was no more. So once my son had that experience, and my husband had also had an experience of seeing something leave the body of his father. He saw a pastel vaporous mist leave his father's body. After those two experiences, I thought, good grief. You know, I've been collecting all of these accounts from my clients, and I've been collecting accounts from people who have been sharing with me about experiences where their loved ones oftentimes will see deceased friends and family who have come to gather them and take them to some sort of afterlife experience, an alternative dimension, the next dimension, or dimensions. Anybody who says they know how many dimensions there are, I really think that they're boxing themselves in. I think there are so many dimensions that it's a whole new frontier. But they would share these accounts with me. And the thing that was so interesting about these accounts is, like myself, once one experiences this, there is this incredible sense that physical death is not the end. Not only did I have accounts involving deceased relatives and loved ones coming to take the dying to the other side, but also, like myself, individuals had been awakened in different locations with a sense that a loved one was moving on, and then received that phone call 5 or 10 minutes later validating that. Then there were accounts where they would actually see their loved one. There's a historical account of a man who was sitting at his table, and it was breakfast time, and he looked out the window, and he saw his mother, and he thought, what the heck is she doing here? She lives quite a ways away. Well, I guess she has come for a visit. And so he went to go to the door, and she wasn't there. But then he received word very shortly after that she had passed on in a location some blocks away from where he was living. Then there was the account where a family was sitting at dinner, and they saw their neighbor walk through the house, and they wondered, and she just kind of walked through the room and walked on out, and the question was, what is she doing here? That's odd. And then they received word that she had passed on at the exact moment that they saw her walking through the house. So not only were the dying and are the dying reporting these experiences, but the living were and are reporting these experiences. So I put out my first book on the topic. I just got really brave, and it was called One Last Hug Before I Go. And what happened with that book was that I received just an overwhelming number of accounts from around the world. And the thing that was so interesting was that they were incredibly similar, regardless of religion, regardless of culture, regardless of language. The theme was always the same, that at the moment of a passing, or an hour before a passing, or a week before a passing, or a month before a passing, it was not unusual for the dying to receive some sort of visitation from somebody who had come to let them know that they were going to be there to help them to the other side. The majority of the time, the individual getting ready to pass knew who this was, and they were very comforted by this. Every once in a while, people became a little bit upset, but eventually they calmed down. And then those who were going to be surviving, they could often have experiences where they were visited, sometimes with a full-blown vision of, you know, grandma all of a sudden shows up and just says, hey, or what happens is they have an experience in a dream. Some people were having what are called precognitive experiences. Right after 9/11, there was a plane that crashed into a community in Queens, back east, and at that exact moment, or just before that moment, I had a dream about the entire event. In that dream, I saw the airplane crash into the community. I saw the trees, I saw the houses, I saw the tail end of the plane. I saw the souls leaving the bodies of the individuals who were impacted. And I thought, oh, my gosh, what a strange dream. And I woke up and I went and turned on the news, which is my habit, and there was the whole scene playing out before me. Well, I found out when I was writing my third book on this topic, Heavenly Hugs, that a man in Canada had the exact same dream that I had. And he and I compared notes. Tit for tat. And so oftentimes when there is a large event like that, like a 9/11 or an experience like in Queens, before 9/11 I had somebody come to me and just tell me that it was going to be all right. And this was right before 9/11. And there are websites dedicated to precognitive experiences before that event. So that's a type of departing vision. So in looking into these experiences, what I began to see was something very interesting. Every once in a while, I get somebody in my office who is as high as a kite on a mood-altering chemical, or they have some type of psychiatric issue going on. Either they're a hypermanic, bipolar individual, or they're having a psychotic episode, or they've got something going on. And in those situations, with each individual, the hallucinations are specific to that individual. So, you know, let's say I have somebody who came in today and they were high as a kite. They're on some mood-altering substance and they're hallucinating. Well, that experience is going to be different than the individual I saw the day before who was maybe having some sort of hallucination as a consequence to a psychiatric disorder. And that's going to be different than the individual from last week who walked into the office suffering from a hallucination. So individuals who have hallucinations that are a byproduct of either a physical difficulty, some sort of neurological disorder, psychiatric issue, an illness, an addiction, those are all going to be different. They're not going to be consistent. Even from, if it's somebody with a neurological issue, let's say I see five people and they all have neurological issues, their hallucinations are going to be different from person to person. But it's not the case with the departing vision. The departing visions are always consistent regardless of religion, ethnicity, age. There are always similarities with these experiences. And so I thought that was really, really fascinating. So what I did was, after putting together that first book and receiving more of these accounts from around the world, I really took a good hard look at them. And I thought to myself, something is really going on here. Now, before I made a decision and the scary commitment to put something out there, because my previous books had been on trauma and addiction and loss, I had been in England, and it was during the time when the bombings were taking place. There were a lot of, the IRA was, you know, blowing things up on the highways, and my husband and I, we got stuck down in the tube because there was a threat, a bombing threat. And so what we did is we, of course, you know, eventually were able to leave the tube and go up on the street, and I found an old bookstore, and I love old bookstores. And in this old bookstore, I was looking around, and I saw this little green book, and it was titled Deathbed Visions. And I pulled it down, and it was written by a physicist named Sir William Barrett. And he and his wife, a gynecological surgeon, she worked with women who were, of course, birthing babies. And, you know, 100 years ago, when women were birthing babies, death was wasn't uncommon.
Oh, yeah.
And so,
oh, yeah.
She had noticed these visions that her patients were having, and she began to see that they're very consistent. Now, her husband was a naysayer. He was a hardcore naysayer. But thanks to his wife, he started to notice with the accounts that she was sharing with him that there were some similarities. And so the two of them put together the first documented collection of departing visions, and they called them deathbed visions. Now, previous to that, there had been other researchers who had noticed this phenomenon, and what they called it crisis apparitions. And these individuals, they were studying all forms of afterlife experience. But they, too, noticed that these, quote, hallucinations were unusual. And so that was my first introduction to written material on the topic. And since then, what's so interesting, so very interesting, from when I put out the first book and the second book and now the third book, is that finally, more researchers are beginning to really, really, really take a look at these. And they're beginning to notice that they're incredibly common, like so many other afterlife encounters. And what's so wonderful is that you have people who are neurologists and neurosurgeons and nurses, and you even have the VA taking a hard look at not only departing visions, but near-death experiences, after-death communications. People are looking at things like precognition. And, of course, the whole field of consciousness has just exploded with the understanding that, wow, consciousness may not be a byproduct of our brain, but consciousness may be filtered through our brain, and that our brain constricts consciousness, and that there is a reason for this, and that consciousness is not local, not located within the brain. So in just a very short period of time, it's been a very interesting journey, to say the least.
Oh, absolutely. And you're right. The field of quantum mechanics and non-locality and all of the insights into what consciousness is is fascinating. And I have noticed as well, you know, many authors recently who have scientific background, who have had these kinds of experiences that then forces them to, because they've experienced it personally, they're forced to really reconsider, you know, their training and their, you know, the paradigms that they, you know, were instructed.
And I totally agree, because when I first got into this whole deal, there was like a little handful of us. There was, of course, Raymond Moody and a few of the heavy hitters. As a matter of fact, I went and spent time with Raymond and spent some time in his psychomantium when he was doing Theater of the Mind and taking a look at an ancient, it was called mirror gazing, which was an ancient form of making contact with the other side. And that was a really fascinating and personally a spiritually earth-shattering experience for me. But, you know, during that time, Barbara Romer, she's passed on, but she was a woman out of Florida, a physician who bravely went where no other physician would go. She researched hellish deathbed visions, and she actually read a paper for me when I was really, I got very sick, and so she read a paper for me, and I became friendly with her and enjoyed her to pieces. There are a few other people. There was Kenneth Ring, who has gone on to do other things, but he was researching near-death experiences and was very, very involved. And then there was, of course, Bruce Grayson, who he's out of the University of Virginia, and he was one of the groundbreakers, too. And then my literary agent, interestingly enough, John White, wrote one of the first books on death and dying, and he, of course, is involved in all sorts of things, and he continues to agent for crybabies like myself. And but you know, just this beginning crowd, you know, this beginning crowd, and they basically, these are the folks who got the International Association of Near Death Studies off the ground, and that organization has now taken off, and of course it all of these other individuals, they're minimally involved. But I guess what I'm saying is that back then it was risky for people to step out of the box and put themselves out there. And I remember a newspaper referring to me as some sort of New Age wacko, as opposed to taking a look. I was heartbroken. How could they be so mean to me?
I know, that's not fitting.
No. I mean, I really was, after being in a situation where I was on all of these major television talk shows and radio programs talking about serious topics like PTSD and addiction, and I was very used to receiving a little bit of respect, you know, not like gobs, but a little bit of respect. And then to go through what I went through in the early years in trying to talk about departing visions, I'll never forget one woman who she worked with death and dying. And I talked to her about maybe doing a little bit of research, and she just really, the hair on the back of her neck stood up when I started talking about what it was I wanted to take a look at. And she, too, insinuated that I was some, again, New Age freak who was trying to take advantage of the dying and X, Y, and Z. And I was very, very stunned by the reactions that I received. But today I think it's absolutely fantastic that so many of these other individuals who have a real scientific background have stepped up to the plate.
Oh, I agree. Well, you know what? We're just a little past the halftime here, so why don't we just take a quick break, and then when we return, we'll continue. And this is a fascinating discussion, and the people in the chat room are enjoying it. So thank you, Carla. So everybody, stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Hey, Robert, it's Chris from Curious Times. Just want to let you know I read your book, Joy Potential, thought it was an awesome story, and the twists and the turns were great. I felt like the characters were just really easy to relate to. I most appreciated how the book delivers some sage advice without making you feel like you're being lectured to, and without feeling like I was reading another one of those thousands of self-help books written by some spiritual guru. Very entertaining learning, and the book left me wanting to know what happens next. Thanks so much, and good luck with this book, Robert.
Hi, it's Maya at Mind Over Matter in Nyack, New York. I'd just like to take a moment to share with you how amazing I found Robert Sharpe's book, Joy Potential. It kind of found me at a time when I was feeling out of sorts and overwhelmed and I guess derailed by the pressures of my career and my large family and caregiving an ailing husband. I just really felt like my spark was dimming. It was a perfect time for me to pick up Joy Potential because as I just in the first few pages began to read, I found that my frame of mind wasn't so different from others dealing with challenges and the trials and tribulations of life. I guess my first feeling was that I wasn't alone, and with that I began to open more to receive the message that Robert gave of light and love and positive thinking. That's what Joy Potential is all about. His thoughts are beautifully written, and everyone, whether you're going through your own personal challenges, should read it. His message was certainly well received from me, and I'm thankful for his insight and his caring and really helping me to get back on track. I think everyone should put Joy Potential on the top of their reading list. Love and light. Thank you.
For more information, visit www.joybook.me. That's joybook.me. Or call 843-808-0777.
Okay, everyone, that was a wonderful little testimonial I received from Maya a couple of days ago, and I want to thank her again for that. It truly meant a lot to me. So anyway, getting back to today's show, my very special guest again is Carlo Wills Brandon, and we are talking about Deathbed Visions, and you can find out more about Carla and the 12 different books that she's written at her website, which is www.carlawillsbrandon.com, and that's CarlawillsBrandon.com. And again, I do have a direct link to her website in the show page description. Okay, Carla, we're back.
Well, let's see. Where should we go from here? I know what I'm going to talk about a little bit. I'm going to talk a little bit about, a lot of people ask me, what happens to them is that we live in a really death-phobic society, and it's very youth-driven also. It's incredibly youth-driven. And so here's what I see happening. This is just my two cents. I see all different types of individuals in my practice. And what I notice is that I have a lot of baby boomers who are coming in, and they are incredibly death phobic. And so what they end up doing is they produce children who are death phobic. And so the children and the grandchildren of baby boomers are not exposed to funerals. They're not exposed to, I will have folks who will come in and they will say, I need to tell my children about the death of their grandmother. And my question will be, well, are they going to the funeral? And the response will be, oh, no. Oh, no. Or I was working with a young man who was about 8 years old, and his father had passed. And I asked him, I said, well, did you go to his funeral? And he said, oh, no, no, not at all. And so what's really concerning me is that I'm getting a lot of these younger children in the office who have death phobia, and they act it out in a variety of ways. And children begin to have an awareness of death when they hit Oh, I would say probably 5, 6, 7, or 8, depending on family circumstances, losses. And so, you know, 100, 200 years ago when somebody was getting ready to pass, let's say back in the old country, when one of my relatives was getting ready to pass in Russia, chances are the entire family was present for the event. They were present for the event, and people cried and expressed their emotions and said their goodbyes and said things like, I'll see you when my time comes, I'll be joining you soon, I'll miss you, but I will soon be with you. And children were also present for this. So death was a part of the landscape, and there was this understanding that physical death wasn't the end. And so when somebody passed, they were typically laid out on the table in the home, and family members prepared the body, and then somebody sat with the body, and people talked to the spirit of the one who had moved on. There were real patterns of behavior around death and dying. Well, with materialistic science, yeah, we've gotten some wonderful things out of that, but what's also happened is that death has become almost like a disease. And so people typically die in nursing homes, and they typically die by themselves with a nurse, or they die in hospitals. My mother died in a hospital. She was completely over-medicated. She was by herself. And so when she passed, of course, the alarm went off, and that's how they knew that she had moved on. Well, what that does for our culture is that fosters death phobia. And so we are becoming a little more hedonistic. I do have to say that. And spirituality is kind of taking a back seat. Of course, there are like-minded people who get together, and I know I'm guilty of this. I'm surrounded by people who think the way I do. So what I'll do is I'm surrounded by people who talk about afterlife experiences and their contact with alternative dimensions, and I'm working on leaving my body and, you know, all this. And have you watched the latest Thomas Campbell video? Thomas Campbell is this fantastic physicist who talks about out-of-body alternative reality and the physics involved with quantum physics and how that plays into it. So, yeah, I mean, these are my people. So when I go to a dinner and I start trying to have a conversation with normies, I get the look, and I'm reminded, oh, my goodness, out there in the normieville, this isn't common discussion. And so when people come into my practice and we get past this and that and the addictions and the relationship problems, we get down to spirituality. And I've had ministers and priests who are spiritually bankrupt. They don't have a sense of spirituality. And so what is going on in our culture right now is that there is this sense of spiritual bankruptcy, and this is being passed on down to the following generations. And what's happening is that the impact is more profound. And so my job is to teach individuals how to talk to their children about death and dying and work with them on dealing with their own death phobia. And talk to them. So many people don't do simple things, like they don't have a will, or they don't talk about what kind of things should be taken care of. If they want a funeral, don't want a funeral, do they want to be cremated? Those things aren't really discussed. And I'm talking people in their 80s who don't discuss these things.
Yeah.
And so, sadly, my job has become that of educator of death. And so I have to confront the issues around, okay, so how did your parents deal with death and dying? Okay, so we talked about that and we worked on that. How did your grandparents deal with death and dying? And then if they don't know, then what they need to do is they've got to go find out, okay, so when did these changes begin to happen? What do your grandparents say about their parents? How did they deal with death and dying? Were there major losses that nobody talked about in the family?
Yeah, it is so interesting because there's a kind of a lively conversation going on in the chat room here about that. As far as, you know, one person said that some of their funerals were treated as family gatherings, you know, and then there's a couple people like me that I am not a funeral person. And I've gone to a couple, you know, when my, you know, grandfather died, you know, I was there, and you know, I guess it's the seeing the person that seems to overtake, for me, it seemed to overtake the visions of, you know, being alive. So, I mean, and, you know, and again, this, you know, and of course my family was very much like yours in the sense that, you know, some of these things were just never spoken about. And, but when it came time for my father's passing, he was in the hospital, and it was one of those cases where we had some, you know, I mean, he was very medicated too, but I mean, it was just like there was a really strong connection. Now, he did choose to pass when I went out to dinner, even though I was there for days and days and hours, you know, and I recognized the fact that he probably, you know, knew ahead of time that that would have been good for me, you know, and that's okay. You know, I'm completely, you know, okay with that. But you know, it is interesting that our, you know, how much our upbringing really plays into that. Now, I do know someone, my partner's mother. She will go to funerals of people that she doesn't even know, you know, just to be there, you know, and, you know, of course it's a small town, but still, I'm just amazed, you know, that, you know, because for them, you know, it's a, yeah, I mean, it is a celebration of the person's life, you know, and it does seem to be like a social gathering. Now, probably I would venture to say that, you know, a person's spirit, you know, would be hanging around at that particular event if, you know, that would kind of seem to be the case. Wouldn't you say that?
Oh, my goodness, they do come. I mean, I have been at funerals where I have sensed strongly that the person who has passed is there, sitting right there, and taking stock of who's there and what's going on. You know, let me tell you a story real quick. My mother-in-law, she had fantastic departing visions. She was a naysayer. She was a college professor. She had escaped the Holocaust with my father. Her mother had died in the camp. She had lost so many relatives in the camps in Auschwitz. And so when she was passing, she started calling out to my father-in-law, and she called him by his pet name, which was Malpa, which means monkey in Yiddish. And when he came, of course, she argued with him and said she wasn't going to go, that she wasn't ready. And we were wondering what the deal was, and we thought, like yourself, well, maybe if we leave, she'll move on. And we came back the next morning, and there she was, still arguing away. And, you know, we die the way we live, and she loved to argue. We always said she did recreational arguing. Well, when her mother showed up, that was a wound that she had forever and ever and ever. When her mother showed up, it was the healing began. At the moment of death, the healing began, which happens often. And then she was able to move on. But in the Jewish tradition, there is no embalming. And people, folks are buried within 24 to 48 hours. And my son was 16, and we were at the funeral home, and he said he wanted to see his grandma. And we said, sure. And so we took him to see her, and he took one look at her, and he said, oh, yep, no one's home. And he turned around and he walked out. So for him, what it was validation that, yes, that life that was in her was no longer there and it had moved on. So everybody is different with regard to, some people don't like to go to funerals because of the embalming and because the person doesn't look the way they did in life and because it doesn't seem authentic. And so they prefer, and that's perfectly okay. They prefer to remember them as they were. And other people have celebrations, and other people, what they do is they are private about their grief. Even if we have departing visions or an afterlife communication where the deceased come to us, some people have experienced a full manifestation where they have seen my godfather, a good, you know, ethnic soul, he saw his deceased wife around the house for a while, and he was a pipe fitter, for crying out loud. He didn't know what the New Age movement was. But some people, after a passing, will see their deceased loved ones. Or like myself, I saw my deceased loved ones in spirit form. They were in energy form. Other people will see their deceased loved ones in a dream. They'll come to them after the fact in a dream, or they have a strong sense that they're there with them. You know, I always, when I'm cooking that good old ethnic food that I grew up on that gives you, you know, clogs your arteries, my grandmother, she's right there. I always sense her and feel her, and I have a conversation with her. So, but the deal is, we have, as a society, we've got to get to a place where we can begin to talk about this stuff. And I think that for your listening audience, if they, for those who have had experiences, contact with the afterlife, who have maybe themselves gone out of body and visited alternative dimensions, or maybe they're just very well studied in this sort of information, it's important for us to reach out to those who are still really scared and say, hey, look, I have some information for you that might help you out a little bit. Here's some books. Here's some of my experiences. Here are some people you can go listen to on YouTube. Sir, you don't have to be so scared, or it's okay to talk about it. Or if somebody does pass and it's a friend, they can say, look, here's some things that I can do for you to help you when you're ready. Just let me know, and I'll be glad to be there for you and provide you with some information. But that's how it starts.
Yeah, you know what? We have a caller here, and we're kind of getting down toward the end, but let me go ahead and take it. I believe it might be Hugh. Hello, is this you, Hugh?
Yes, it is, Robert. Fascinating.
I thought I recognized that phone number. There you go. I know we're kind of late into the show, but did you have anything you wanted to talk to Carla about?
Yes, I left a message for her on the telephone because I don't use email, as you know, and you can to learn a little bit more about me too. But I have profound documentable spirituality through my whole life. I've had UFO, paranormal, near-death experiences, and some very powerful information, and I have ways to help Carla get her work out. It needs to get out, like she said, bigger and better to the world. And I have a business partner who's a psychologist for over 40 years, and his wife is a psychologist, just like she and her husband.
Okay. All right, well, good. Well, then that's good to know then. Then she can probably contact you offline then about that.
Yeah, or if you want to coordinate it, that would be wonderful, so we can give you credit too.
Okay, no
well,
problem.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Hugh.
Thank you, Robert.
You're welcome. Okay, well, you know, we're actually down to the last 5 minutes. This has just been wonderful, Carla. I've really enjoyed this. If you have, you know, obviously, I mean, you just kind of gave some advice for those people, you know, who, you know, may have friends or family who have, you know, someone who just recently passed. Is there anything that you can, you know, tell some of us who may have experienced it or you know, how maybe if we have those kinds of experiences, maybe how we should treat them?
Well, here is the issue. When I went to visit Raymond Moody and went into his psychomantium, the first three psychomantiums I went into, I had no experiences at all. And when I went into the fourth one, and all it is a dark, pitch-black room. You can trip over yourself and break your neck. That's how dark it is. And it's a mirror and it's a chair. And you sit in the chair and you wait to see what happens. Well, I had a lot of things happen in that little room, and I could hear Raymond in the next room talking on the phone. And I, like I said, I made contact with a number of deceased relatives and saw them, and they touched me, and it was very overwhelming. Well, at that time, I didn't know who to talk to. I didn't know where to go with that. I was very overwhelmed. So the first thing I did is I wrote it down. Always, anytime you have an experience like that of any sort, if you have a premonition, write it down and date it. If you have any type of afterlife contact, write it down. Next, go on the web and Google it and see what you can find. See if you can find anything that's similar to the experience that you have had. Then search around for links of like-minded people, people that you can talk to, message boards. Go on Facebook and take a look. Look for books to see if there are any books that resonate with you. And just start searching. Start looking and start searching. You can also start your own page on Facebook if you're brave, if you've had experiences and you want to gather some like-minded people. Go ahead and start your own page. I have a YouTube channel where I have a number of little clips that talk about departing visions. That's how I got started putting it out there a little bit more. I have a page on Facebook called Carla Wills Brandon Author Digs page where I post information about afterlife contact, quantum physics, new and upcoming individuals who are doing some of this work. So that folks who are kind of shy and don't really want to say, hey, Mom, guess what happened to me? It's kind of like they can go quietly and anonymously and look at some of this information and begin to get some validation for themselves so that they can begin to feel more comfortable in their own skin. Once we feel more comfortable in our own skin about our experiences, then we can take care of ourselves and talk to people about what it is we have encountered. Now, if we haven't had any experiences, of course, there are all sorts of how-to books out there. And let me tell you something, what works for one person may not work for another. So those are just a few little quick tips right there.
Wow, that's very good. Thank you very much. And, yes, everybody definitely join Carla on Facebook. And, again, check out her website. There's quite a plethora of information that she has there. And, Carla, thank you for your time today. I really enjoyed our conversation very much.
Well, thanks, Robert. I appreciate it, too. And, you know, just keep up the good work because we need those voices in the wilderness to spread the message.
Exactly. Thank you very much. Everyone, I want to thank you for joining us tonight. And, again, we do have a show tomorrow, and it is from 7 to 8 p.m. Eastern. And my guest is Rebecca Norrington, and we'll be talking about her program, Reality Spirituality. So I hope you'll be able to join us for that. And, again, I want to thank you for joining us today. And until we meet again, cruise on.
Thank you for tuning in.
Oops.
Thank you.
There we go. Now we're exiting.
You've been listening to ByteRadio.me's Mystical Cruise Show. To become a friend or follower, visit www.blogtalkradio.com/ByteRadioMe. You can also find us on Facebook and on Twitter at ByteRadioMe or at our website www.ByteRadio.me. That's BiteRadio.me. Until we meet again, cruise on.